Hi, I'm Claire Wright.
And I'm Eve Rees.
And we are historians. And if this introduction sounds to you like a confession or an act of sharing our addictions, well, you're right. We are here to tell you about our addiction to the archives.
So welcome to our podcast, Archive Fever, where each episode we'll be conducting intimate conversations with writers, artists, curators, fellow historians, and other victims of the research bug.
We're going to talk to these archive addicts about what kind of archives they use, how often they use them, when they got their first hit, and what is their funniest, saddest, most frustrating, and most illuminating experience in the archives.
And we'll be asking the question, what madness is this?
I reckon it's not really fair to ask others to expose their deepest, darkest archive secrets without showing something of our own underbellies. So I'm prepared to say to you now that I know what this feeling is like deeply, with every beat of my historian's heart. I know that compulsive gambler feeling of just wanting to have one more hit, like, you know, to sit at the pokies and just push that button one more time and see what the outcome is going to be. That's what it's like using Trove or other finding devices. You just want to have one more go and get that shoot of adrenaline. What do you reckon?
I've totally been there myself. I know that feeling all too well. So many times I've found myself sitting in my office late into the night, just hitting the search button again and again and again, and then ending up getting late home. And we should probably let everyone know that this concept of archive fever we're talking about, we haven't invented it. We've kind of stolen it from the French theorist Jacques Derrida.
Yeah, you're right. It was the French theorist Jacques Derrida who first coined this phrase, archive fever, for this kind of psychic grip or the repetitive return to sources. And I've got a really good quote. Can I share that with you?
Yeah, read it out.
Okay, so in 1995, he described the impulse like this. To have mal d'archive, that's French for archive fever because Derrida is French after all, is to burn with a passion. It is never to rest interminably from searching for the archive right where it slips away. It is to run after the archive, to have a compulsive, repetitive, and nostalgic desire for the archive, an irrepressible desire to return to the origin, a homesickness, a nostalgia for the return to the most archaic place of absolute commencement. God, don't you love that? A homesickness.
Wow, yeah, I can definitely see myself in that list of symptoms, and it describes my archive fever all too well.
Okay, let's just consider that this is Archives Anonymous. We're in a safe place. We can share without fear of judgment. Tell me when you first got the research bug.
Well, like all addictions, I think for me it goes back a long way, probably to my childhood. I really grew up, now that I look back on it, surrounded by archives. Domestic archives, to be sure, but very much archives in the sense they provided traces of the past. That really fascinated me and gave me a kind of obsessive desire to look through archival objects at a really young age. So I grew up in a big old rambling terrace house that was full of cupboards and like strange little drawers full of papers. My mother was an obsessive hoarder, so she kept kind of everything. So maybe that fed my archive fever or created it, who knows? So I have very strong memories of looking through all these old papers and photographs as a child and getting my mother to kind of explain the meaning of them to me, to sort of be the historian and tell me what this domestic archive all meant. Later, it became a way for me to connect to my grandmother who died before I was born, to look through photographs of her in her, you know, 1950s clothes, in the sort of black and white photographs, try and wonder what kind of woman she was. It was also a way for me to try and connect to my mother's 1970s activism. She had some great photos of her at protests or doing street theatre. And then on the other side of my family, my paternal grandmother was adopted, and she spent most of her adult life, or all of her adult life, really trying to find out what happened to her natal, her biological mother, who was a 1920s showgirl from England who came out to Sydney on a tour and, you know, was a pretty good time girl and had a lot of fun and ended up getting pregnant and married and had my grandmother. But then for a whole series of reasons, it ended up that motherhood and marriage wasn't for her, so went back to England. And then my grandmother, her daughter, was adopted out and never found out what happened to her real mother. And so I grew up hearing these stories about this kind of obsessive search through archives to try and find out what happened to her mother. So I think I kind of inherited that sense that, you know, we're surrounded by archives and they're the way we find out who we are and try and connect with these kind of lineages, particularly kind of maternal lineages that, you know, are the bedrock of our identity.
That is so interesting to me because I've actually never thought about it this way, but I'm the complete opposite.
Oh, really?
My mother was a chucker outerer. She threw husbands away. She threw countries away. We moved to Australia when I was 5 years old, just my mother and I. And she threw memories away as well. She always claimed to have a terrible memory. Mm-hmm. And we brought effectively nothing with us when we came to Australia. I'm really the opposite to your situation. And when I tried to grill my mum for a kind of sense of the past or a sense of belonging, she'd always say things like, I forget. I had one photo album that was of her and my dad from when they were together and their life before me. And I went through that quite obsessively, I now realise. It was kind of the only archive of my own life that was around us. And then going on to my dad's side, well, his family were immigrants to America from Poland. And then my stepfather's family were Holocaust survivors and they didn't leave Europe with anything either. There was a kind of absence of archives in my life. Maybe that's why I was drawn to the traditional archive, to the conventional archive that is held in libraries. And I can certainly remember the moment that I fell, that I was bitten. Mm. It was in year 12. And for our Australian history final assignment, we had to do an actual research project. And we were supposed to base it on primary research. And this was something that was completely new idea about doing history. Up until this time, history was just something that your teacher stood at the front of the room and it came out of a textbook. But here she was sending us into the archive. And I spent 2 weeks at the State Library of Victoria in my spring holidays researching a project about how the Yarra River in Melbourne went from being a babbling brook, as it was described in some early letters by European settlers, to a fetid cesspool. And that was it for me. I mean, that whole process of looking for letters, diaries, newspaper accounts, and finding these layers and peeling back the onion, and I guess was the complete antithesis of the way that I'd grown up, which is that I kept hitting a brick wall every time I'd ask a little sort of childhood question about where do I come from?
Yeah, that's fascinating because I feel like, you know, in my experience, I was kind of doing archival research from day one. And it was only when I realised you can do this as a job that I was suddenly hooked. And I have a similar memory of when I was a teenager of getting to do my first original research project. Of course, I chose the period of 70s activism I was already obsessed with through my mother's story of her wild youth in Sydney share houses. I researched the Green Bans, which were a protest movement to stop heritage houses in Sydney being pulled down. I won a prize for that essay. And so I suddenly realised all my obsessive hunting through old fragments from the past that I do in my spare time anyway, well, A, I'm good at it, and B, it's a thing, it's a job. You can be a historian and that can be your entire career.
So, okay, what does archive fever look like to you?
For me, it's that really compulsive pull to keep looking and looking and looking that you've already kind of alluded to. The psychological basis of it is so similar to other sorts of addiction. You know, I often think in another life I would have been a great alcoholic or, you know, or gambler, because it's that same need to always need another hit, another hit, another hit. And when you don't get another hit, you always think if I try again, maybe I'll get the hit. So for me, it's either on the digital archive of Trove, which is, you know, this wonderful resource of digitised newspapers and periodicals from Australian history. And so if I'm looking on that, it's, you know, another search term. Maybe I'll find what I'm looking for, that golden nugget that will answer the question or provide the perfect quote or example to illuminate the argument I want to make. Or if I'm in the physical archive, it's always, you know, if I order another file, what's going to be in that? Because I think, you know, physical archival documents, the way they're housed really feeds into archive fever because they're all anonymous. They all look the same. You know, every archive box from the outside is just this bland white or beige cardboard box. And it's just that mystery, you know, not knowing what's inside. Is it going to be completely dull, completely irrelevant, or is it going to be a juicy personal letter or diary that just, you know, makes great reading and will provide, you know, a wonderful story to feed the kind of history I want to tell?
I'm with your sister. It really is that sense of pure happiness. For me, this is what archive fever feels like. Unlike a true sickness where you're laid out and you just can't wait to feel better again, when I am in that lather of discovery, of the quest, of the one more search term, one more grey anonymous box, can you please bring it to me so I can open it now? That is a state of pure joy, pure unadulterated joy. And because of the rest of my life, I'm a mother, I have three kids and, you know, other professional responsibilities, it's always like just trying to cram that joy into a session. My perfect week is when I get to go to Canberra, which I think of as nerdvana.
It totally is.
Totally, yeah. Nirvana. Every single beautiful archival collecting institution all there within walking distance of each other. So here's what my perfect week looks like. I wake up in the hotel. I have breakfast. I walk over the bridge over to the parliamentary zone, to the National Archives or to the National Library. I'm waiting at the door when it opens at 10 a.m. I walk in, I go into the collections room and I sit down and I take my pencils out and I line them all up in a row and make sure that my sharpener's there and I've got my rubber. And then I will do a full stint until lunchtime and then I'll go down to the cafeteria and I'll just get a sandwich. And I might have even made that sandwich at the buffet breakfast, truth be known, and popped it into my bag.
Still got student habits.
And then I'll do an evening stint and they will have to chuck me out at 8 p.m. And then I will float home on a magic carpet ride of bliss back to my hotel and do it all again the next day. So for me, archive fever also looks a lot like OCD. It's very ritualistic. It has a great sense of the ceremonial about it. And if I can stretch it out to a full week, that to me is just a perfect state of happiness.
Which is interesting because some people have conceptualised archive fever quite differently. The well-known historian Carolyn Steedman wrote a book called Dust, which is sort of seen as a classic work discussing kind of historical practice. And she also engages with Derrida's concept of archive fever, but for her it's a state of anxiety that there's never going to be enough time to get through all the boxes and read all the files before you have to go home. Because of course, you know, as you've already mentioned, archival work is often about travel. It's about leaving your ordinary life behind, getting on a plane or a train, and spending a quite confined period of time away in an archive. And for Carolyn Steedman, and I must admit also for me, that sense of a compressed space of time can cause a lot of anxiety. You know, you've ordered all these boxes. You would love just to be able to kind of sit through and like leaf through the pages and just sort of ponder, you know, in a kind of wise, scholarly way what you read. But really, the clock is ticking. For me now, and I know for a lot of historians, you know, a lot of archival work is more about taking photographs than taking notes often these days. And then there's that kind of panic that comes in the last day where you, you know, order your final files and then suddenly 20 boxes come out on a trolley and you think, oh God, how am I going to get through them all? So Carolyn Steedman describes this archive fever as the knowledge that you will not finish, that there will be something left unread, unnoted, untranscribed. For her, it's that sinking feeling when you know there's all these boxes you're not going to get through, but you still have to get home because you have that booked flight.
Yeah, I get that anxiety and, you know, that maybe the smoking gun is lying in that next box. And yes, certainly technology has changed now that we all have a phone in our pockets. And if you get that app Scannable, do you use Scannable?
Oh, I love Scannable. Yeah. It changed my life.
Yeah. So, you know, we're all scanning away these archives. It actually just prolongs it because you've got to take it home and then you're doing it in your office. So how do you feel actually being in the physical place of the archive changes the way that you relate to what you're finding there, as opposed to coming out of that bubble and then bringing the archive back into your daily life and your daily rituals with you.
You're definitely much more immersed in the material when you're in the physical archive. Because my secret archive confession is that I've certainly taken many, many, many photographs in archives or scans that I have never looked at again. You know, you always think there'll be that perfect week in the future sometime when I don't have other commitments and I can just sit down and print off all my photographs and read through them and get in that deeply immersed space. But of course it never happens. You know, the busyness of life takes over. So what for me is so special about being in the archive yourself is that ordinary life does stop. And so you can really throw yourself into the stories that you're reading about and think through the problems you want to write about and the lives you're talking about them in a whole new way that you never get anywhere else.
I must admit, I'm not a very anxious researcher. I probably more go to Derrida's more romantic notion of obsession rather than, you know, possibly the more self-flagellating ones. I think the anxiety lies in the fact that you are experiencing such a level of self-education, that you're learning about these people and you become attached to the people that you're reading about and you're feeling like you're living in the time and you are there, you are there. And it's a shock to come out of that space, but you come out of that space with a sense of obligation to the archive to make other people feel as enthusiastic and as immersed and to give them the sense of being there. And for me, I think that's probably always my greatest fear. How am I going to be able to communicate just how much fun and how much pleasure I've gotten out of this experience? Because ultimately, when you then translate it into your own words, the archive can become dry and flat and dusty again. Like, it's living in its flesh when you are consuming it. You render it into words and it just melts away again.
So what's one archival find that really excited or surprised you, that you thought, God, this is something I really need to bring to life to readers?
I was sitting in the State Library, again, my spiritual home, and this is when I was researching my book on Eureka, and I was looking for women's accounts of their experiences in the goldfields in the 1850s, and there was an archival collection of a woman called Martha Clendinning, who was a shopkeeper and a doctor's wife at the time. She later had a daughter, and her daughter became involved in a romance with Robert Reed, who was the gold commissioner in Ballarat in 1854. Now, Reed was much older than Martha's daughter, Isabella. So this is happening now. I'm talking letters that are there in this archive between Isabella and Robert Reed. And he's pursuing her through these love letters. And I felt almost kind of embarrassed reading them because they were so passionate and they were so full of ardour and slightly stalky, actually. Like, he really was not leaving her alone. And he was getting very polite replies from her that suggested that she'd really rather he desist. It gave me a whole different sense of who this man was, because he was a certain kind of fellow in the Eureka story. And here he was, showing a whole nother side of him, this vulnerable, romantic side of him. And the thing to me that capped it off was I was looking through one of the tiny little envelopes that contained the letters that he had written to her. And I took the letter out and I read it, and I was about to put the letter back into its tiny envelope when I realized there was something else in there. And I turned it upside down, and into my hand fell these most frail, precious, dry little pressed flowers. Robert Reed had been sending Isabella flowers. Whether he pressed them before he put them in the letters or whether they had become compressed over the 150 years that they'd been sitting in the archive, I don't know. But I can tell you, those flowers broke my heart. Now, I have to confess that my true desire was to pop these little flowers into my purse.
Of course.
And take them home with me. I felt like I was the third wheel in this relationship. Somehow it had turned into a love triangle and I was one of the partners. And I also felt kind of certain that I might have been the only person, aside from Isabella, who had ever seen these flowers in 150 years. There was no sign that anybody else had gone through this particular archive in the way that I had. Part of me was thinking, who would know? But of course I resisted and I didn't do that. I lovingly, gently placed them back into the envelope and put them back into the file, and some other researcher will find them one day and will possibly make something completely different out of them than I did. But I did later write a paper that I gave as a speech at a fundraising gala, actually, at the State Library of Victoria. I possibly gave it some justice, but at the same time, I think a lot of what we labour under in archive fever is really personal, and you can never actually share the experience with anybody else.
Yeah. I often think about that the strangest thing about being in archives, you know, the biggest dramas of human existence, of love and death and marriage and childbirth and travel and careers, it's all playing out in front of you and you're so attached. And then these dramatic moments happen and you want to share that moment with someone or communicate it somehow. But you look up and then there's just, you know, an archivist kind of typing away on the computer and maybe one or two other people in the room kind of dutifully taking notes. And you can't kind of yell or scream or call anyone. You're totally alone in that experience. And even if you do tell someone later, they don't really care in the same way you do because they haven't been sitting next to you in the archive reading all the same letters you do. It's a strange experience because on the one hand, it's incredibly solitary. But it's also about human connection. We're connecting to other lives, normally dead people, across years or across centuries.
So tell me about your most precious or indeed your most confronting find.
My most kind of unexpected find, I don't know if I'd say it was confronting, was a similar love note. I was researching a big project about Australian women who travelled to the United States in the early 20th century. And these were largely women who were very professionally ambitious, but they felt a bit constrained by the kind of sexism of Australia at the time and the limited opportunities there were for women to pursue their ambitions. So this one woman was a pioneering female librarian who went to do her graduate studies at the University of Chicago and then came back to Australia and went on to become a really important leader in the development of librarianship education in Australia. So I was reading through her papers. They weren't the most exciting papers in the world. There was a lot of discussions about different methods of filing books in libraries and, you know, whether or not librarianship was a real science. And then all of a sudden, amongst all these dry bureaucratic letters, a little white envelope, there was this incredibly passionate and explicitly erotic love poem that had been handwritten, and it was called Morning Tea. It contained, you know, some quite explicit material, which is probably a bit too...
What, you mean like sexy material?
Very, very sexy material.
Sexy librarian material.
Yeah, there are a lot of body parts explicitly mentioned. Should I read them out?
Yeah.
I don't have the full poem here, but one line says, "From breast to cunt, I burn with deep desire." There is also, "Your pulsing penis bursts into my womb."
Wow, no wonder you had archive fever.
I know. So I was a bit kind of flustered by reading this. It got me a bit excited in the reading room of the National Library. And it was particularly interesting. But she was, like many of the women I studied, a very private figure. These women all had very successful professional lives. They travelled and had careers at a time when, you know, very few women were doing that. So I didn't know much about her personal life beyond this. There was some rumours that maybe she was sort of interested in women, but here was, you know, seemed to be a kind of explicitly heterosexual sexual encounter being played out. So I was, you know, very curious about what this all meant. And I never found anything else about it. This just one little poem stood alone.
I guess that raises a really ethical concern that we have in the archives sometimes when we are in a lather, driven by archive fever further and further down the rabbit hole. Maybe some things are meant to stay there. Is it our duty to excavate them and bring them up and into the light of day? Or are some things better lost to time?
Well, exactly. And even though that poem was a kind of exciting find that told me things about her personal life that I didn't know before, was it really relevant to the history I was telling? You know, I was focused on her professional career. Is it just a kind of gratuitous, salacious detail to put it into the story? You know, what are her family going to think about it? There are all these kind of ethical questions that we are confronted with all the time.
Do you reckon that there are any misconceptions around working in archives?
Definitely. Often it's seen as a really glamorous activity. You know, there is a kind of undeniable privilege to getting to travel to do archival research. But often, I think, to be honest, in my experience, the day-to-day of it can be really humdrum and, you know, stressful and boring, because those sort of moments when you find nuggets, I mean, they're few and far between. There's a lot of hours of just sitting there leafing through material in, you know, what are often pretty strange locations. So I've done a lot of archival research in the United States because of my project on Australian women going to the US, which has involved, you know, getting on a plane by myself, flying to some pretty random locations. You know, I once spent a week in a really tiny college town deep in the south of Illinois, you know, 4 hours south of Chicago, kind of surrounded by cornfields. So it can be really kind of a lonely, quite surreal experience.
And that's when you pull out your librarian's letter. If this is Archives Anonymous and we're here to share, my dirty little archive secret is that I've never worked in an archive outside Australia.
No.
I have never set foot in the British Library or the Library of Congress or the New York Library, indeed any of those little buttonhole archives that you're talking about. And I think that I am possibly the only professional historian I know who has never been out of Australia to do archival research.
Well, maybe that's a plus because you don't get the kind of isolating, you know, long trips overseas that are, you know, can be
associated. I just get to drive to Ballarat a lot.
Though I think you're missing out because the British Archives, the National Archives in Kew in London, it's really probably my favourite archives to work in. You know, they really hold, in a sense, not just Britain's records, but almost, well, a huge chunk of the world, because they have the records for the whole British Empire. It's also just a great kind of people-watching exercise.
You're making me very jealous. Indeed, on the last book that I wrote, the Your Daughters of Freedom, which did involve extensive records from England because the women that I was writing about, Australian women who had gone over and worked for the British suffragettes, there are a lot of those records, and I would have loved to have gone over and sat in the women's library. It used to be called the Fawcett Library, and that has the largest collection of suffragette material in the world. But unfortunately, I wrote the book on such a short timeline that I didn't have the opportunity to go over there. And I did something that I've never done before. I employed a research assistant. I found online all of the items that I wanted her to view, and then I got her to go in there and use her scannable document, emailed it all back to me, and then I went through the material. And it was really interesting because on one level, it shouldn't have been any different. It was what I would have been doing if I was there looking at the same material. And yet it just felt, well, I wasn't in a fever at all. It was a very pallid experience. It made me realise how much of the archival research situation for me is about the actual physical immersion in the building, in the space. It is that fever that, as we're saying, has attracted us to being historians in the first place, and it's what keeps us going. I think it's going to be great over the remaining episodes of our series, Archive Fever, to talk to others, not just historians, to writers and artists and poets and theatre makers and people who do research to create the products they do, and to get their take on what Archive Fever looks like for them. I feel like we could sit here and talk forever about our mutual love of the archives, but we're going to have to wrap it up. So until next time, I'm Claire Wright.
And I'm Eve Rees. And you've been listening to Archive Fever, a La Trobe University podcast recorded and produced by Matt Smith on Wurundjeri land. Wurundjeri sovereignty was never ceded, and we pay our respects to their elders past, present and emerging.
You can subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you choose to listen. Our theme music is by Poddington Bear. You can hear more at soundofpicture.com.
You can follow Claire on Twitter at Claire A. Wright or on Instagram at Claire Wright Historian.
And you can follow Eve on Twitter at Eve Rees.
Coming up in the next episode.
From the police brief of evidence through committal hearings, then to a trial, the information changes and the stories become more and more desiccated. By the time the trial takes place, those giving evidence really are, you know, almost just giving their names. That's interesting, just how the information's whittled down.